Please be advised that the views and opinions expressed by Richard Martin of LATAM Investments, LLC, are entirely his own and do not necessarily represent those of the company, its affiliates, or its officers. Investments made on the basis of Mr. Martin's comments are unsolicited by the company and are at the sole risk and prejudice of the listener or investor.
This is Richard Martin, and all things being equal, it should be Monday. That would be the 13th, 15th, or 16th of March, and this is the wake-up call, and this is a recorded message to you. So please, please do not call in with questions. It will not help. There will be nobody to answer the phone. However, please feel free to continue to write in your questions to my email at rmartin@lataminv.com. Once again, and that's LATAMINV, Latin American Investments, LATAMINV, LATAMINV. Once more, the email rmartin@lataminv.com, added to which I can give you my direct line telephone number if you would like to call me directly with your questions and concerns and comments and problems, etc. And that number is 305-579-2012. Once more, my direct line number is 305-579-2012. Now, as I explained on Thursday, I am away this week. I will be away until Friday, so please don't call me until Friday. You just have to leave a message, and you might just as well wait and call me when you have some time, and either next weekend or sometime the following week. That would be good. All right, so I am going to start with a description of what debt is and what it isn't. You know, debt isn't bad in and of itself. And you're going to hear more and more about how debt is an evil financial antic. It certainly is not. Debt is fine as long as it's going to productive uses or as long as the lending itself is backed up by saving somewhere. No one can argue that savings shouldn't be lent. One of the purposes of having savings is that it is invested. And some of the investments are loans. That's the nature of investments. So if you loan out your hard-earned money because you hope to get money back, which is more than you loaned out, which is investments returned to you in the form of interest or capital gains, if it in fact is a deal that you financed and then you received the profits from that deal, well, of course, that savings which has gone out to be lent. The problem with credit is when it is extended as it has been without the backing of savings to those, by the way, who had no possible means of paying it back. And in addition, with leverage and with no money down. Now, think about this. The difference between healthy credit financed through savings and credit which is just spun off a computer in the form of digital dollars by people at institutions such as the Federal Reserve, which I shall be talking about in a couple of minutes, by the way, an organization so evil and so corrupt that, frankly, it defies the imagination, because that's its job, is to see how much credit it can kind of spin out into the system without getting caught, as it were. Well, now it's got caught, but that's, you know, cold comfort 80 or 90 years later, you know. And, of course, needless to say, all these shenanigans could never have happened without fractional reserve lending. Now, fractional reserve lending, we've talked about the idea that banks have a legal right to lend out X times the amount of money that they have on deposit. You know, clearly, debt is not the lifeblood of the economy. And by extension, credit is not the lifeblood of the economy either. It is savings that is the lifeblood of any economy. Because without adequate savings, extending credit is nothing but a pyramid scheme that eventually implodes, which is, of course, what has happened. You know, and the amazing part is that the solution in Congress is to encourage more reckless lending with no savings attached. You know, this Ponzi financing scheme cannot possibly work, ladies and gentlemen. And therefore, if it can't work, of course it won't work. Now, let's have a look at some of these proposals that have been put forward to solve the problem by rewriting the books on mark-to-market accounting. Now, mark-to-market accounting simply means that any investments or any assets must be graded and must be valued on a regular basis according to their current market values. That's why they call it mark-to-market. Now, these proposals make for good sound bites, of course, but they miss the boat entirely, because if the banks hadn't lent with leverage and instead put those loans on the books in a hold-to-maturity portfolio, which they could, by the way, have done, then the banks would never have been in the trouble they're in today. And the reason the banks purposely put those assets into a mark-to-market portfolio is that that allowed them to increase the leverage, i.e. the number of loans they could make with nothing to back them up. Why? Well, because with leverage comes increased profit potential and increased risk. Banks were just speculating, pure and simple. See, without that excess leverage, banks would have had losses, but they would still have been solvent. And we wouldn't be in this mess. It was the excessive leverage that destroyed Bear Stearns, Lehman, Citigroup, AIG, Bank of America, Merrill Lynch, etc., etc. Not mark-to-market rules, evil short sellers, or hedge fund bets via credit default swaps. You know, suspending this mark-to-market accounting does nothing to reduce the leverage. So suspending mark-to-market accounting cannot fix the underlying problem. Instead, such gains may further enhance the already huge mistrust in the system. Look, to fix the problem, you have to go to the root cause. And the root cause is fractional reserve lending that allowed banks, brokerages, and insurance companies to leverage themselves up to these insane levels. Not a single peep has come from the Fed, the Treasury, or the administration about addressing the real problem. Instead, we just hear this complete nonsense about how to get credit flowing again. And I think that half the trouble is that the people who should have done what was the correct thing to do and did the opposite are now looking for scapegoats. They're looking to try to muddy the water so people don't get what the problem really was. They don't actually understand why this thing couldn't work in the first place. They don't understand that it was the very proponents of these leveraged loans that caused the trouble. And so those proponents are now busy trying to cover their tracks and tell everybody that other things are the problem and that, you know, different laws need to be created and wasn't their fault, etc. Look at Alan Greenspan going around telling everybody, well, I couldn't have known that there was a bubble in the housing market. When he admitted that he did know that there was a bubble in the stock market back in 1995-96 and then promptly did nothing about it. So, you know, ladies and gentlemen, it's up to you. You know, you need to be sure you understand what the problem is. And so for your own peace of mind and your own sanity, you can put this whole thing into perspective. All right. I had an email from Samir on the 13th of February, which is over a month ago, actually. In fact, I got two requests. I got one from Samir, and I got one from Mary Lou, which came in just last week on March the 5th. And Samir says, "Hi, Richard. Would you please take a few minutes in your show to discuss the Federal Reserve and Fannie Mae? From what I understand, both are privately owned institutions, but are financed and regulated by our government. It doesn't seem to make much sense to me to have private interests controlling our money supply and heavily influencing the housing markets. I would be grateful if you would explain the logic in the formation of these institutions. Thank you for your honest education and commentary of our current economic situation. Samir." Well, thank you, Samir. Why don't I just read out Mary Lou's email at the same time, which was, "Dear Richard, have just listened to your show. It is interesting to hear the analogy with the crash of 1873 and quite interesting to hear about the inevitable depression caused by the baby boomers' dip in spending, although I must admit I don't quite understand the argument." Well, Mary Lou, the argument is very simple. If people don't spend, then there is a recession, because if people don't spend, people don't buy, and if people don't buy, other people don't make and manufacture, and if people don't make and manufacture, then all the other industries that feed into the manufacturing industry will shut down as well. So you have a knock-on effect, all because the consumer isn't spending. And if the baby boomers are retiring, they will spend less, because they need to have their savings to prorate over the rest of their lives. And if they spend less, then they, being the largest demographic of spenders out there, is going to cause a downturn in the economy. I hope you get the argument a little better now. I just wanted to push that one in. So I continue. "What you predict is dire. Expect massive bank failures. Have reserves on hand for emergencies. The drop of the market in 2008 is just the beginning of a long slide, which sounds like a meltdown. But I did hear you say twice to hold on to the dollar at present. In this climate, how can we even conceive of investing? That is why I was thinking of a safe local community bank to keep cash in CDs or just savings account. I'm not afraid, but I am responsible for my father's grandchildren. He had created trusts for them, and I worry about the outcome. They are still young and will need it for their studies. Listening to your show, it seems there is nothing to stop the wreckage, but I will keep in touch and consider what you told me. One last question. Could you explain on your show what the Fed did and why we may go back to the gold standard? What would that mean, and why would it help? I am just very ignorant. Merci bien et à la prochaine. Marie-Lou Finardi." Well, let's start with the Federal Reserve, okay? The whole world, Mary Lou, is in a state of complete confusion. You know, Americans are coming to the realization that their lives have been a grand illusion. You thought your neighbor had it made. They were driving a Mercedes, spending $40,000 on a new kitchen with granite countertops and stainless steel appliances. They sent their kids to private school. They had a second home at the shore. They took exotic vacations all over the world. Now, their house is in foreclosure, and you are paying to bail them out. The anger and outrage in the country is at the highest level since the Vietnam War. The American public is being misled by government officials, politicians, and the Federal Reserve regarding the causes of this crisis and the solutions needed to solve the economic tribulations. The problem, at least part of the problem, is that the average American doesn't really know very much about the Federal Reserve. The government and the Federal Reserve actually prefer to operate in the shadows. If the American public understood what their policies have done to their lives, they would, and probably will be, rioting in the streets. Even Henry Ford had a similar opinion, and I quote, "It is well that the people of the nation do not understand our banking and monetary system. For if they did, I believe there would be a revolution before tomorrow morning." Most Americans believe that the Federal Reserve is part of the government. Well, they're wrong. It is actually a privately held corporation owned by stockholders. The Federal Reserve System is owned by the largest banks in the United States. There are Class A, B, and C shareholders. The owner banks and their shares in the Federal Reserve are a secret. Why is this a secret? It is likely that the biggest banks in the country are the major shareholders. Does this explain why Citicorp, Bank of America, and J.P. Morgan, despite being insolvent, are being propped up by Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, and Tim Geithner, the head of the Treasury? Look, I'm going to go on talking about this, but I will apologize to those of you to whom I've said this before. One of the problems that I have on the wake-up call is that I'm sort of gathering new listeners as we travel forward, and so I have to explain things sometimes to people who haven't heard them before. I think it's only fair to do that just from time to time, because you know, it's hard to put things into context if you don't really understand the background. So that's why I'm using today, Monday, as the opportunity to do this while I'm away, so that you know, I don't have to deal so much with your questions and your emails, and I have a little bit of time to develop on the theme here, which I intend to do. So do bear with me if some of you are familiar with this. So the history of the national banks in the United States has always been controversial since the founding fathers signed the Declaration of Independence. The Constitution of the United States unequivocally states that only Congress has the authority to coin money, not an independent bank owned by unknown bankers. And this is what it states. The Congress shall have power to coin money, regulate the value thereof, and of foreign coin, and fix the standard of weights and measures. That comes from Article 1, Section 8 of the U.S. Constitution. And you know, it's our most horrifying recent experience with an all-powerful central bank, which has led to the current worldwide financial crisis. That is what is responsible. Let's cut away all of the elements that I gave you during the wake-up call, ladies and gentlemen. Let's just ignore all that. Let's just assume that none of it exists at all. Just the very existence of the Federal Reserve, the country's central bank, which is neither federal, by the way, nor is it a reserve, is in itself the responsible element in the fact that these frightful days of financial crisis are upon us. You know, in less than one century, the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States has destroyed the currency and allowed bankers to gain unwarranted power over the country. They had and continue to have the ability and the opportunity to bring down the entire world financial system. You know, when the average American is told that the dollar has lost 95% of its purchasing power since the inception of the Federal Reserve in 1913, they look at you with a blank stare. The systematic inflation created by the Federal Reserve silently robs the average American of their standard of living every day of the week. And the CPI figures published by the U.S. government tell the story. The government began keeping official track of inflation in 1913, the year the Federal Reserve was created. And for the 70 years before that date, there was no inflation in this country. And guess what? There was no central bank. The CPI on January the 1st, 1914, was 10. The CPI on January the 1st, 2009, was 211.1. This means that a man's suit that cost $10 in 1913 would cost $211 today, a 2,111% increase in 96 years. This is the same as a 95% loss in purchasing power of the dollar. There were two events that took place in the years following the creation of the Federal Reserve. Inflation ran at double-digit rates to finance Woodrow Wilson's foreign intervention into World War I, and the years following President Nixon's closing of the gold window in 1971. This second event led to rampant inflation that wasn't tamed until the 1980s by Paul Volcker, the only independent, courageous Federal Reserve chairman in its history. The figures so far in the 21st century seem modest. This is due partly to the methodical downward manipulation of the calculation by government bureaucrats. The period from 2010 to 2020 will show a dramatic jump caused by all of the money printing and reckless spending that is occurring today. The average American might just conclude that prices always go up, so what's the big deal about inflation? This is where the Federal Reserve and politicians have pulled the wool over your eyes. The CPI was 20.9 in 1964. Today, it's 211.1. This means that prices have risen 683% since 1964. But the problem, ladies and gentlemen, is that your wages have not risen at the same rate, even using the government-manipulated CPI. Using a true CPI figure, average weekly earnings are 64% below what they were in 1964. And this explains why a family of five could live well with one parent working in 1964, but even with both parents working and using debt in prodigious amounts, the average family doesn't live as well today. How many people know this? You all accept it, it was taken for granted. Oh, well, you know, women work today because of, you know, women's lib and the rights of the woman and all the rest of it. That's a smokescreen. Women work today because they have to. Because the Federal Reserve took away all their money. Well, let's look at the history here. The first Bank of the United States was created in 1791. Alexander Hamilton, the first Secretary of the Treasury, proposed this bank and convinced a hesitant President Washington to agree. John Adams and Thomas Jefferson were against the concept. It favored the moneyed classes of the North versus the agrarian South. The bank was given a 20-year charter, and President James Madison let it expire in 1811. He then renewed the charter in 1816. Well, President Andrew Jackson was the first and only president in the history to pay off the national debt. He worked tirelessly to rescind the charter of the Second Bank of the United States, and he gave his reasons for abolishing the bank, which were: it concentrated the nation's financial strength in a single institution, it exposed the government to control by foreign interests, it served mainly to make the rich richer, it exercised too much control over members of Congress, it favored the northeastern states over the southern and western states. President Jackson believed that only Congress should be responsible for the issuance and control of the currency, delegating that duty to powerful New York bankers was distasteful to him. And he said, "If Congress has the right to issue paper money, it was given to them to be used and not to be delegated to individuals or corporations." President Jackson's anger at the bankers should resonate today, as bankers have again brought this country to its knees. "Gentlemen, I have had men watching you for a long time, and I am convinced that you have used the funds of the bank to speculate in the breadstuffs of the country. When you won, you divided the profits amongst you, and when you lost, you charged it to the bank. You tell me that if I take the deposits from the bank and annul its charter, I shall ruin 10,000 families? That may be true, gentlemen, but that is your sin. Should I let you go on, you will ruin 50,000 families, and that would be my sin. You are a den of vipers and thieves. I intend to rout you out. By the grace of the eternal God, will rout you out." a president with Jackson's strength of character will put the blame where it belongs today. And I don't think his name is Barack Obama, if you really want my opinion. He would rout out these criminal bankers rather than give them more taxpayer money to squander. A president with a moral backbone would put an end to the disastrous 96-year experiment of the Federal Reserve. Instead, our last two spineless presidents have put Goldman Sachs bankers in charge of the National Treasury. An examination of inflation throughout the history of the United States proves from independence, through wars and industrial revolution, the country experienced virtually no inflation as the country was backed by gold. The creation of the Federal Reserve in 1913 and the closing of the gold window in 1971 unleashed a tsunami of inflation that continues to this very day. In 1848, Karl Marx published his Communist Manifesto. It included 10 planks. Two of those 10 planks were as follows: a heavy, progressive, or graduated income tax, and centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank with state capital and an exclusive monopoly. The dates February the 3rd, 1913, and December the 24th, 1913, framed a year which placed this country on a downward fiscal spiral. The United States had tinkered with an income tax during the Civil War and in the 1890s, but the Supreme Court declared it unconstitutional. Until 1913, the U.S. government was restrained from overspending because it was completely reliant on tariffs and duties to generate revenue. The 16th Amendment changed the game forever. The Congress shall have the power to lay and collect taxes on incomes from whatever source derived without apportionment among the several states and without regard to any consensus or enumeration. When you give a congressman a dollar, he'll take $100 billion. The initial tax rates of 1% to 7% were rather modest. That didn't last long. The top rate of tax reached 92% during the 1950s, and today rates are still 500% to 1,000% higher than they were in 1913. The government is addicted to tax revenue. In 2007, they absconded $1.2 trillion in taxes from American individuals. Does anyone think that the bloated government bureaucracy spent these funds more efficiently or for a more beneficial purpose than its citizens could have? Without $1.2 trillion in individual tax revenue, congressmen would not be able to add 9,200 earmarks to the current $400 billion federal spending bill every year. So let's look at Rothschild, and I quote, "Those few who can understand the system will either be so interested in its profits or so dependent on its favors that there will be little opposition from that class, while on the other hand, the great body of people mentally incapable of comprehending the tremendous advantage that capital derives from the system will bear its burdens without complaint and perhaps without even suspecting that the system is inimical to their interests." That's Rothschilds of London. Now, the House of Rothschilds has been the dominant banking family in Europe for two centuries. They were known for making fortunes during panics and war. Some claimed that they would cause panics in order to take advantage of those who panicked. The panic of 1907 was used as the reason for creating the Federal Reserve. The Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis attributed the causes of the panic in 1907 to financial manipulation from the existing banking establishment. Let me repeat that. Federal Reserve Bank of Minneapolis attributed the causes of the panic in 1907, which was the main reason for creating the Federal Reserve, to financial manipulation from the existing banking establishment. And what did J.P. Morgan have to say himself? "If Knickerbocker Trust would falter, then Congress and the public would lose faith in all trust companies and banks would stand to gain," the bankers reasoned. And that's exactly what happened. In 1906, Frank Vanderlip, vice president of the Rockefeller-owned National City Bank, convinced many of New York's banking establishment that they needed a banker-controlled central bank that could serve the nation's financial system. Up to that time, the House of Morgan had filled that role. J.P. Morgan had initiated previous panics in order to initiate stronger control over the banking system. Morgan initiated the panic of 1907 by circulating rumors that the Knickerbocker Bank and Trust Company of America was going broke. There was a run on the banks, creating a financial crisis, which began to solidify support for a central banking system. During this panic, Paul Warburg, a Rothschild associate, wrote an essay called A Plan for a Modified Central Bank, which called for a central bank in which 50% would be owned by the government and 50% by the nation's banks. In November 1910, a secret conference took place on Jekyll Island off the coast of Georgia. Those in attendance were J.P. Morgan, Paul Warburg, John D. Rockefeller, Bernard Baruch, Senator Nelson Aldrich, Colonel House, Frank Vanderlip, and Benjamin Strong, Charles Norton, Jacob Schiff, and Henry Davidson. Out of this meeting of the most powerful bankers and politicians in the country came the plan for a central bank. This conference was incredibly unknown until 1933. In 1935, Frank Vanderlip wrote in the Saturday Evening Post, "I do not feel it is any exaggeration to speak of our secret expedition to Jekyll Island as the occasion of the actual conception of what eventually became the Federal Reserve System." Behind the scenes, these powerful men were formulating the plan for a Federal Reserve System. There was no outcry from the public to implement this plan. The public knew nothing of this. The Aldrich plan was renamed the Federal Reserve Act and pushed forward by Paul Warburg and Colonel House. Warburg essentially wrote the act and pressured congressmen to see his way or lose the next election. Colonel House, who had socialist leanings, was the top advisor to President Wilson. The Glass Bill, the House version of the final Federal Reserve Act, had passed the House on September the 18th, 1913, by 287-85. On December the 19th, 1913, the Senate passed their version by a vote of 54-34. More than 40 important differences in the House and Senate versions remained to be settled, and the opponents of the bill in both houses of Congress were led to believe that many weeks would elapse before the conference bill would be taken up. The congressmen prepared to leave Washington for the annual Christmas recess, assured that the conference bill would not be brought up until the following year. The creators of the bill then pulled the ultimate scam on the American public. In a single day, they ironed out all 40 of the disputed passages in the bill and quickly brought it to a vote. On Monday, December the 22nd, 1913, the bill was passed the House by 282-60 and the Senate 43-23. This meant that the single most important piece of legislation ever passed by the Senate was missing the votes of 26 senators because it was passed during the Christmas recess. President Wilson, at the urging of Bernard Baruch, signed the bill on December the 23rd, 1913. A few years later, President Wilson had second thoughts, and I quote, "I am a most unhappy man. I have unwittingly ruined my country. A great industrial nation is controlled by its system of credit. Our system of credit is concentrated in the hands of a few men. We have come to be one of the worst ruled, one of the most completely controlled and dominated governments in the world. No longer a government of free opinion, no longer a government by conviction and the vote of the majority, but a government by the opinion and duress of small groups of dominant men." Well, there were some brave Americans who did oppose this legislation and foresaw the devastation that it would lead to. And I quote Senator Henry Cabot Lodge, December the 17th, 1913. "Throughout my public life, I have supported all measures designed to take the government out of the banking business. This bill puts the government into the banking business as never before in our history. The powers vested in the Federal Reserve Board seem to me highly dangerous, especially where there is political control of the board. I should be sorry to hold stock in a bank subject to such dominations. The bill, as it stands, seems to me to open the way to a vast inflation of the currency. I had hoped to support this bill, but I cannot vote for it, because it seems to me to contain features and to rest upon principles in the highest degree menacing to our prosperity, to stability in business, and to the general welfare of the people of the United States. Congressman Charles Lindbergh, Sr., also in 1913, said, "From now on, depressions will be scientifically created." John Maynard Keynes, the current hero of the Obama administration, and Paul Krugman, had this to say about the Federal Reserve in 1920. "Should government refrain from regulation, taxation, the worthlessness of the money become apparent and the fraud can no longer be concealed. By this means, government may secretly and unobserved confiscate the wealth of the people, and not one man in a million will detect the theft." Well, according to the Federal Reserve's own website, their duties fall into four general areas. One, conducting the nation's monetary policy by influencing the monetary and credit conditions in the economy in pursuit of maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Two, supervising and regulating banking institutions to ensure the safety and soundness of the nation's banking and financial system and to protect the credit rights of consumers. Three, maintaining the stability of the financial system and containing systemic risk that might arise in financial markets. Four, providing financial services to depository institutions, the U.S. government, and foreign official institutions, including playing a major role in operating the nation's payments system. The American public was told that the Federal Reserve would eliminate any future bank panics. From 1913 through 1920, inflation increased at more than 10% a year, as Wilson spent vast sums during World War I and its aftermath. From the early 1920s to 1929, the monetary supply expanded at a rapid pace and the nation experienced tremendous economic growth. Benjamin Strong, one of the participants at the secret conference on Jekyll Island, was the Federal Reserve head. By the end of the 1920s, speculation and loose money had propelled asset and equity prices to unsustainable levels. The stock market crashed in 1929, and as the banks struggled with liquidity problems, the Federal Reserve cut the money supply. This was the greatest financial panic and economic collapse in American history so far, and it never could have happened without the Fed's intervention. The Fed caused the bubble with loose monetary policy. The Depression didn't become great until the Smoot-Hawley Act in 1930 destroyed world trade, and the raising of the top income tax rates from 25% to 63% in 1932 destroyed the incentive to earn money. Over 9,000 banks failed, and a few of the old robber barons' banks managed to swoop in and grab up thousands of competitors for pennies on the dollar. The Federal Reserve's primary mandates were maximum employment, stable prices, and moderate long-term interest rates. Their other chief function was to supervise and regulate banks to ensure the banking system was safe. Let's assess their success regarding their mandates. Unemployment reached 25% during the Great Depression, attained levels above 10% in 1982, and will reach 10% in this coming year. Grade? Failure. Based on the CPI data since the Federal Reserve's inception, the dollar has lost 95% of its purchasing power. Grade? Failure. Interest rates have been anything but moderate since the inception of the Federal Reserve. They have consistently caused booms and busts by having rates set too low or too high. grade failure. The Federal Reserve was supposed to supervise the activities of banks. Instead, under Alan Greenspan, they stepped aside and let banks take preposterous risks while giving an unspoken assurance that the Fed would clean up any messes that they caused. This total dereliction of duty, gross negligence, has led to the greatest financial collapse in history. Grade failure. Lewis T. McFadden was the representative from Pennsylvania in 1934. He fought a lonely battle against the Federal Reserve. He was swept out of office when his opponent in the next election received thousands of dollars in campaign contributions. This is what he had to say. Mr. Chairman, we have in this country one of the most corrupt institutions the world has ever known. I refer to the Federal Reserve Board and the Federal Reserve Banks, hereinafter called the Fed. The Fed has cheated the government of these United States and the people of the United States out of enough money to pay the nation's debt. The depredations and iniquities of the Fed have cost enough money to pay the national debt service several times over. This evil institution has impoverished and ruined the people of these United States, has bankrupted itself, and has practically bankrupted our government. It has done this through the defects of the law under which it operates, through the maladministration of that law by the Fed, and through the corrupt practices of the money vultures who control it. Well, Mr. McFadden has a soulmate in Representative Ron Paul from Texas. Mr. Paul has been on a one-man mission to abolish the Federal Reserve for over a decade. He seems to be the only person in Congress with the courage, fortitude, and intellect to understand the damage that has been caused by the Federal Reserve and call for its abolition. The entrenched political class despise Mr. Paul because his call to abolish the Federal Reserve would destroy their ill-begotten wealth and power. And this is what he had to say on September the 10th, 2002. Since the creation of the Federal Reserve, middle and working class Americans have been victimized by a boom and bust monetary policy. In addition, most Americans have suffered a steadily eroding purchasing power because of the Federal Reserve's inflationary policies. This represents a real, if hidden, tax imposed upon the American people. From the Great Depression to the stagflation of the 70s to the burst of the dot bubble last year, every economic downturn suffered by the country over the last 80 years can be traced to Federal Reserve policy. The Fed has followed a consistent policy of flooding the economy with easy money, leading to a misallocation of resources and an artificial boom followed by a recession or depression when the Fed created bubble bursts. In conclusion, Mr. Speaker, I urge my colleagues to stand up for working Americans by putting an end to the manipulation of the money supply, which erodes American standard of living, enlarges big government, and enriches well-connected elites by co-sponsoring my legislation to abolish the Federal Reserve. And again on July the 11th, 2006, he sized up his colleagues in Congress and the Federal Reserve perfectly when they were oblivious to the impending disaster that was about to befall the nation. He was belittled by the mainstream press and fellow congressmen. The coming dollar crisis is not likely to be fixed by politicians who are unwilling to make hard choices, admit mistakes, and spend less money. Demographic trends will place even greater demands on Congress to maintain benefits of millions of older Americans who are dependent on the federal government. Faced with uncomfortable financial realities, Congress will seek to avoid the day of reckoning by the most expedient means available, and the Federal Reserve undoubtedly will accommodate Washington by printing more dollars to pay the bills. The Fed is the enabler for the spending addicts in Congress who would rather spend new fiat money than face the political consequences of raising taxes or borrowing more abroad. The irony is that many of the Fed's biggest cheerleaders are the same supposed capitalists who denounced centralized economic planning when practiced by the former Soviet Union. Large banks and Wall Street firms love the Fed's easy money policy because they profit at the front end from the resulting loan boom and artificially high equity prices. It's the little guy who loses when the inflated dollars finally trickle down to him and erode his buying power. Someday, Americans will understand that Federal Reserve bankers have no magic ability and certainly no legal or moral right to decide how much money should exist and what the cost of borrowing money should be. And then this awful, grotesque monster, Alan Greenspan, before he became a tool of the political ruling elite and the bankers who truly control the country, actually understood and supported a currency backed by gold, ladies and gentlemen, if you can believe that, when it couldn't be manipulated by corrupt politicians. The confiscation of middle-class wealth through the insidious use of inflation has proceeded unchecked for 96 years. And this is what this man said when he was green behind the ears in 1966. In the absence of the gold standard, there is no way to protect savings from confiscation through inflation. There is no safe store of value. If there were, the government would have made its holding illegal, as was done in the case of gold. If everyone decided, for example, to convert all his bank deposits to silver or copper or any other good, and thereafter declined to accept checks as payments for goods, bank deposits would lose their purchasing power and government-created bank credit would be worthless as a claim on goods. The financial policy of the welfare state requires that there be no way for the owners of wealth to protect themselves. This is the shabby secret of the welfare statists' tirades against gold. Deficit spending is simply a scheme for the confiscation of wealth. Gold stands in the way of this insidious process. It stands as a protector of property rights. If one grasps this, one has no difficulty in understanding the statists' antagonism towards the gold standard. This was Alan Greenspan in 1966, a far cry from the Alan Greenspan of the late 90s and the 2000s. Well, you know, anybody who is not angry and resentful at this point is simply not paying attention. Your tax and spend corrupted politician leaders and your banker-controlled Federal Reserve have borrowed and spent your tax dollars, your children's tax dollars, and their children's tax dollars, desperately attempting to prop up this bankrupt system. The unleashing of a never-ending tsunami of printed dollars by the Federal Reserves makes every dollar worth less. They have systematically created inflation that has slowly but surely reduced your standard of living. Politicians in the pocket of lobbyists, corporate interests and bankers have used their power to tax in order to spend trillions on worthless projects in their districts to ensure re-election. The combination of taxing and printing has led to a national debt of $11 trillion. You see, bankers love debt. The more debt, the more interest they collect. Issuing credit cards and collecting 21% interest and billions in late fees seemed like a can't-miss proposition. It was until people just couldn't pay the debt back. Now the unwinding of the greatest debt bubble in history has created a second Great Depression. Instead of learning from the past, the Federal Reserve has chosen to do exactly what led to the crisis. They have lowered rates to 0% and they have printed money at prodigious rates. The Fed has doubled their balance sheet in the last 12 months. They have loaned billions to the bankrupt banks that inhabit our financial system while accepting worthless pieces of paper as collateral. They have hailed back to Jekyll Island and the cloak of secrecy. They will not reveal to the public the banks they have loaned money to or the collateral that backs up those loans. The arrogance of Ben Bernanke proves that the Federal Reserve answers to bankers and not to the American public. The books and records of the Federal Reserves are not open to scrutiny by the General Accounting Office. Ron Paul has introduced the Federal Reserve Transparency Act, which would open their books to the public. No organization with as much power as the Federal Reserve should be permitted to operate in the shadows. Well, the future is cloudy, but the direction is clear. Government will spend trillions of dollars. Congress will increase taxes on the rich and secretly raise taxes on the masses by calling them cap and trade fees. The Federal Reserve will pull out all stops to try to create inflation. When you owe the rest of the world $11 trillion, inflation makes the debt less burdensome. There is no solution that will not be painful to everyone in the United States. The only solution that would put America back on a path of sustainable prosperity would be a gold or precious metals-backed currency that would force the government and its citizens to live within its means. Congress would need to vote for something that would take away its power. With the current political system, this is impossible. Money is power. This leads to only one conclusion. The existing Ponzi scheme will have to collapse before a rational financial system for America can be adopted. It may take decades. Well, you know, there is an excellent 1994 book called The Creature from Jekyll Island, A Second Look at the Federal Reserve System by researcher G. Edward Griffin, which I recommend to you all, by the way. It goes into deep historical detail about money and banking, the creation of the Federal Reserve banking cartel, and the corruption of the inflationary fiat money system. Personally, I think this book is a must-read for any American who is trying to understand the past century in terms of the financial shenanigans. The book is still in print, and it can be bought from Amazon Books. You know, I'm convinced that when the history of the Western world is written many years from now, the times we have lived through the last 60 to 80 years, maybe 100, will be labeled by most historians as the age of illusion. Students of the future will wonder in amazement why it was that a people could become so stupid to let an obviously flawed system ever get established. They will look back on Americans as they look back on the Inquisition, witch burnings, medical bleedings, etc., thinking only very stupid, lazy, greedy, gullible people who were uneducated and superstitious, easily intimidated and shamed, could have allowed such depredations on those they supposedly cared about. These students will dream about the end of, if only I could have lived back then, I would have told them, not knowing that there were dozens who tried in vain to warn and arouse people to their immediate enslavement and destruction. Congressman Ron Paul, will you please stand up? Well, we are well and truly on the road to national insolvency, ladies and gentlemen. And you know, insolvency doesn't just mean liabilities exceed assets. It also refers to being unable to pay the interest and principal on one's debts and to cover one's other expenses. And the USA is headed right there. You know, how could the US government become insolvent? You know, when the costs of its servicing rapidly increasing debt rise to the point that it no longer is able to pay its mandatory bills. The mainstream business media is offering some faint recognition that borrowing several trillion dollars a year might have some consequences, such as higher interest rates and less money available for public sector borrowing. You know, let's start at the beginning. Let's, you know, see if we can build a more comprehensive context for all this. Okay. One, the United States government does not print money to fund its deficit. It borrows the money on the open market by selling treasury bills of varying maturities. Two, the Treasury sells a 90-day T-bill, then in 90 days the coupon of that bond is paid, and the Treasury has to sell another T-bill to replace the one it just paid off. If the government pays off $1 billion in short-term T-bills in any particular week, it must auction $1 billion of new T-bills to replace those paid off, i.e. roll over the debt. Three, to cover this year's deficit, the Treasury must sell more T-bills. Thus, the Treasury won't just auction $2 trillion of T-bills to fund the 2009-2010 federal deficit. It must also sell untold billions more to replace all the Treasury debt which is coming due and must be rolled over into new Treasury bills. Four, the current era of low interest rates, also known as cheap money, has allowed the Treasury to borrow stupendous sums of money at low rates of interest. Five, even at these historically low rates, the interest on the national public debt, that is not including the interest paid on the Social Security Trust Fund, which is considered intergovernmental holdings, reached $260 billion in fiscal year 2009. The Treasury includes all interest, including that paid to the Social Security Trust Fund for the Social Security taxes collected, but probably loaned to the general fund to spend, so you find news articles like Uncle Sam will pay $450 billion this year just to cover interest on the national debt. According to the National Treasury Department report released on December the 10th, the federal government expects to pay $44,070,000 in interest on Treasury's debt securities for fiscal year 2009. The Health and Human Services budget, which includes Medical and Medicaid, will cost $739,241,000 for the fiscal year. Social Security Administration, $699,976,000, and the Defense Department military budget, $656,722,000. The Treasury's own accounting of the debt states that the debt held by Social Security Trust Fund and other governmental agencies is $4.4 trillion, and the remainder of the debt owed to citizens or external owners is $6.6 trillion. According to the Treasury, the average interest paid on this $10.95 trillion in debt is 3.7%. In January 2001, not very long ago, the average interest paid was 6.5%, almost double the current rate. Historically, a rate of 6 to 7% is not uncommon. So 6.6. Thus, a return to 7% interest rates would in effect double the interest rate paid annually to nearly $1 trillion a year. As I've already said, this debt is spread out over varying maturities, so a rapid rise in interest rates would only affect a small portion of old debts first. Nonetheless, all new debt would be paying the new higher interest rates, and every month, more of the existing $11 trillion in debt would roll over at the higher rates. Think of that $11 trillion in debt as a mortgage, which resets to higher interest rates as the owner keeps adding debt. Just like the homeowner who manages to make mortgage payments when the low teaser rates are in effect, but who is unable to pay the mortgage when rates revert to the actual market rates, the U.S. government will become insolvent as rates rise. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is your rationale. That is what tells you why the U.S. government will become insolvent. Understand that very well, what I have just told you. This is exactly what is going to happen in the United States of America. And my job is to make absolutely sure that you are aware of this. I need to be certain that you are absolutely clear as to why it is that there is no question at all but that the American government will become insolvent within the next 5 to 10 years. It cannot be otherwise. The mathematics dictate the reality and the truth and the inevitability of what I have just told you. And this has been a very fraught hour, ladies and gentlemen, not much joy. But I hope you have become convinced that the Federal Reserve is an institution which has got to go. So will somebody please tell Ron Paul that he's doing a good job? Will they please tell him that what he said was understood and gratefully acknowledged by a few people and that it needs to be spread out over the population at large? Thank you all very much for listening. This is Richard Martin at Richard Martin's Wake Up Call. I will be with you in another recorded message this coming Thursday. Thanks. Until then, bye-bye for now.